North Dakota farmers who brought this case seeking a declaration that they could cultivate non-drug industrial hemp under a North Dakota statute pursuant to a license issued by the state of North Dakota without fear of criminal prosecution under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. The issue in this case is a narrow one. It's not whether whether industrial hemp can be controlled as marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act. It certainly can be. This court so ruled in the White King case, and other courts have ruled to the same effect. The issue in this case is not whether Congress can regulate under the Commerce Clause the intrastate or in-state trade or commerce in controlled substances, including marijuana. Of course it can. That's also a matter of settled law. The question here is whether, given the unique North Dakota state regulatory regime in which the only thing that enters commerce are those parts of the cannabis plant that Congress chose not to regulate, hemp, stalk, fiber, seed, and oil, there would be any rational basis for Congress to conclude that the cultivation of the plants themselves under this system could somehow affect commerce and the market for drug marijuana. And the answer to that is no. Here the state is making sure that the plant itself doesn't leave the farmer's property. So then the question is whether the mere existence of the plant on the farmer's property could somehow affect commerce and drug marijuana. The answer to that is no, and that conclusion follows from two key factual allegations that the two farmers made in their complaint filed with the district court. First, that the type of industrial hemp that they're allowed to grow under North Dakota law, which contains, by state law, less than 0.3% of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, the psychoactive ingredient, in cannabis, is useless as drug marijuana, and so it is not, in fact, fungible with drug marijuana.
Just as a point of reference, since I don't know, you said it's less than 3% THC?
0.3%.
0.3%. What is the, do you know what is the potency of marijuana that is intended for the use for which marijuana is typically put, smoking and so on? Is it, how does that compares? Do you know what the?
It's in multiples of like 100 or more. It's much, much. It's bred, drug marijuana is bred to have high concentration of THC. Industrial hemp is bred to have as close to zero THC as possible. And the second factual allegation that the farmers made is that the cultivation of the plants themselves poses no danger of diversion to drug marijuana. The cultivation of these plants can't be used as a cover for growing drug marijuana or anything of this nature.
Well, why? I suspect the government's going to say that even though your clients have totally legitimate, lawful intentions for growing it and don't intend to divert it off their property, that this would be opening up the floodgates, so to speak, to anybody who wants to grow it, including people who aren't as legitimate as your clients are. And that's a legitimate drug enforcement activity. What would your response be to that?
The response would be that under this state regime, the persons who are permitted to grow and who are permitted access to the plants, the license have to be named, the coordinates of the field are submitted to the state, there's continual inspection, there's no real risk. And again, this is a factual issue, but there's no real risk of that somebody with, as you said, a legitimate intent or intends to divert this somehow, although it's physically impossible, intends to divert these plants to the drug marijuana trade could do so. The district court treated this, dismissed the complaint for failure to state a claim under Rule 12b-6. In doing so, it should have accepted as true for purposes of ruling in the motion for dismiss these two key factual allegations. But instead, the district court actually made or relied on findings of fact that industrial hemp is fungible with drug marijuana, and that it does pose a risk of diversion and the problems with enforcement. And we submit that in making and relying on findings contrary to the allegations of the complaint, the district court did not follow the cardinal rule that well-pleaded allegations in the complaint should be regarded or assumed to be true for purposes of ruling on a motion to dismiss. And we believe for that reason, we submit for that reason that the district court's ruling is erroneous and should be reversed. That's the narrow issue on this appeal.
In the court's decision, it seemed to rely upon language in the White Plume case that addresses your concern about the THC level of industrial hemp and saying that there is enough of a potential there that this can be rationally based.
Yes, Judge Smith, the difference is that the White Plume case, the Court of Appeals was not purporting to make factual findings. It did not involve the Commerce Clause argument or issue that we have in this case, where the actual factual issue of fungibility of industrial hemp and drug marijuana is at stake. We do not believe that the Court of Appeals in that case purported to make factual findings. And to the extent that these factual issues, as we respectfully submit, they are material in this case, to be sure that government disputes them, but to the extent they're material, we would submit that the district court then should have treated the moving papers as cross motions for summary judgment, should have found the disputed issue of material fact, and should have permitted discovery to go forward and the case to proceed on that basis.
And the fact that you think that's material that distinguishes this case from White Plume is that the hemp is processed on the property so that there's the THC component is removed before it ever leaves the grower's property? Is that your argument?
It's not that the THC component is removed. The only thing that leaves the grower's property, and again, under a state regulatory regime, which was not present in the White Plume case, are those parts of the plant, which is the stalk, fiber, seed, and oil, that are specifically exempt from regulation, exempted from the definition of marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act. Have been for 75 years precisely for the purpose of allowing trade.
Why isn't the district court's decision consistent with accepting your allegation as true? Because it seems it could be read as reaching the same result, assuming your allegation was a truthful statement.
Because, Joseph, we would submit that if the allegations were accepted as true for purposes of ruling on the motion to dismiss, the district court could not have concluded that there is any rational basis for Congress to regulate the mere presence of these plants on the farmer's property, because there's no possible impact on or effect on commerce in drug marijuana, which is what Congress seeks to regulate here under the Controlled Substances Act. It's because the district court actually made and advanced and relied on contrary factual findings that it determined there wasn't even a claim, that the complaints failed to state any claim on which relief could possibly be granted. It's in this respect also that the case is not only different from White Plume, but with respect to the Commerce Clause issue from the race case. Race versus Gonzalez, the Supreme Court case. And that case dealt with something that was indisputably drug marijuana. Medical marijuana is drug marijuana. The plaintiffs there contended it wasn't going to be used for commercial purposes. It uses drug marijuana for illicit purposes, but there's no question it was the same thing. Industrial hemp is not. This involves a sort of the opposite situation. Race involved the non-commercial use of drug marijuana, and this involves the commercial use of non-marijuana. It's a very different situation, a very different analysis, and by not, again, at least for purposes of ruling on a motion to dismiss, accepting the allegations that established that we're dealing here with, in effect, commercial use of non-marijuana, the district court erred and determined that the erroneously determined that the Pitcairn Farm is not a stable claim and should be granted.
All right.
Thank
you, Mr.
My time with the permission of the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sandler. Ms. Patterson, and before you start, let me make one comment. You can come to the podium. I neglected to mention at the opening of this morning's session that obviously Judge Bowman is not here. He's a little bit under the weather. He will be participating in the decision. We're taping the oral arguments. He's going to listen to the tapes, and we'll conference after that. And he will be participating in the decision-making, but is not... I guess he's not able to be physically present today. All right. Thank you, Ms. Patterson. Go ahead, Ms. Patterson.
May it please the court, I'm Melissa Patterson, representing the United States Department of Justice and the Drug Enforcement Administration. We ask that this court affirm the district court's dismissal of the complaint here. First, plaintiff's challenge fails for lack of jurisdiction. And second, even assuming jurisdiction, the district court correctly concluded that plaintiff's challenge simply fails on the merits. I'd like to turn to the jurisdictional issues.
Well, if you'd hold off on that one, because I think the district court's analysis on jurisdiction seems pretty sound, I'd like for you to address the appellant's primary argument here this morning that the district court misanalyzed the case by not giving the plaintiffs the benefit of their factual allegations on a motion to dismiss.
Certainly, I would like to return to the jurisdiction later.
Sure, please.
Legal test here, and the Raich court made very clear that what you're looking at in a Commerce Clause challenge is whether or not Congress had a rational basis to legislate as it did. And essentially, plaintiffs have alleged, no, it's not rational because in my particular situation, nothing is going to go interstate. And I think the Raich court's analysis clearly forecloses this argument for several reasons. First, the Raich court noted that the production of commodities, how they're manufactured, is a quintessentially economic activity. And that's sort of the end of the analysis. As soon as plaintiffs can see that they're engaging in a commercial activity and they can see that they're going to be shipping things interstate, then there's simply no basis to continue with the analysis. The only reason the Court of Appeals, which was, of course, reversed in the Raich case, found that the class of activities there wasn't subject to Congress's Interstate Commerce Clause powers was because it was localized and non-commercial. Here we have commercial activity, and that's really at the heart of Congress's Commerce Clause powers. Second, even that rationale, even when there was a comparable state law regime that purported to, as the court said, hermetically seal off these activities, that still doesn't mean that Congress was irrational and being skeptical that a state law regime actually could seal off activities from impacting any interstate markets. And I think here I think what plaintiffs are relying on is the North Dakota regime of control over the proposed cannabis production. And I think the Supreme Court has made very, very clear that what states do cannot expand or contract Congress's Commerce Clause powers.
Well, why wouldn't it be a matter of factual determination as to whether those state efforts could be successful in isolating their intrastate commercial activities?
Well, I think the Raich court suggested that that was part of the legal test. You sort of take a broad view. You don't look at it on a case-by-case basis. Of course, Congress has to make rules that govern everyone, and the Supreme Court rejected any idea that Congress has to make findings with scientific exactitude, or that it has to legislate precisely so that if your commodity is only going to be sold in the state, that somehow you're beyond its commerce class powers. So I think really plaintiff's challenge here boils down to a sort of complaint that the Controlled Substances Act is not narrowly tailored enough, that it encompasses too much. And the only question for this court is whether or not it was rational for Congress to legislate as broadly as it did, and I think the Supreme Court has already said yes. I'd like to return to the jurisdictional issues for a moment, if I may. When Congress vests jurisdiction in a particular court over particular actions, it thereby divests the original jurisdiction of other courts. 21 U.S.C. 877 sets out a direct review scheme where plaintiffs must first go to the Drug Enforcement Administration, get a final agency decision, and then go to the appropriate Court of Appeals. Now, I think the plaintiff's argument is that they don't have to comply with these administrative proceedings because what they're arguing is that they're simply outside the scope of the agency's powers, that as applied to them, or first, that if construed to apply to them, the Controlled Substances Act is unconstitutional. And I think this court, as a matter of precedent, has already rejected this argument. I direct the court to the Great Plains decision decided in 2000, where at issue there was a similar direct review scheme governing the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And there, the plaintiff tried to get into district court and seek a declaration that the CFTC simply didn't have power over him because he wasn't dealing in futures contracts. So he simply shouldn't be forced to go through the administrative proceedings about whether or not he was, in fact, dealing in those futures contracts. Now, properly, this court rejected that challenge and said, look, even if Congress has said you have to go to the agency first, even if what you're asserting is that you should not be subject to that agency's jurisdiction, you still have to take that complaint to the agency first, get your agency decision, and then come into the Court of Appeals. And I think this makes sense for reasons illustrated in this case. Both the Great Plains Court and the Thunder Basin Supreme Court decision that it's based on talk about the dangers of having duplicative proceedings going at the same time. If you can both have your administrative proceeding trucking along and then you jump into district court as soon as you don't like the way the administrative proceedings are going, you risk getting conflicting decisions, it's a wasteful system, and it's simply flying in the face of the congressionally directed review scheme. Now, we're not saying that plaintiffs have to incur criminal penalties or risk criminal penalties to get their challenge here before this court. All we're saying is that they have to comply with the congressionally directed review scheme before they can get into this court. As soon as they have an agency decision, they're welcome to return to this court.
What's the agency decision they would be seeking?
I think what they're seeking is they would file a registration application, which they've already done. They could raise their challenges both to the construction of the Controlled Substances Act, and the agency should address whether or not the statute does in fact apply to them and develop an agency record on that point. And they can also raise their constitutional challenge. Now, it sounds sort of strange to say you have to bring your constitutional challenge to an agency first, but the Supreme Court in the Thunder Basin decision acknowledged the strangeness of that proposition and said, nonetheless, even if you have a constitutional challenge, you still have to take it to the agency first and let them decide. And I think it might be helpful to look at the language in the Thunder Basin decision. And there, the court noted that plaintiff's claims at root require an interpretation of the party's rights and duties under the relevant statute there, and as such, arise under the Mine Act and fall squarely within the commission's expertise.
Now, here, what case, what's the name of the case you're reciting?
It's the Thunder Basin decision. I don't know if it's cited in the briefs. It's
I was going to say, is it in, I don't recall it being in the briefs. I'm looking at your table of cases.
I don't think it is, Your Honor. It's discussed at length in the Great Plains decision, which is the direct circuit precedent on this point in this court. And I can certainly give you the citation now if that would be helpful.
Why don't you send us a 28-J letter so that everybody has it?
Sure. But I think returning to that language, which is the basis for this court's Great Plains decision, I think that at root, what plaintiffs here are also arguing about is their rights and duties under the Controlled Substances Act. And that's a matter that's squarely within the agency's expertise, and the agency should really get a chance to apply their expertise to this challenge before plaintiffs come into court. Now, in their reply brief, I believe plaintiffs assert that by denying them district court review on this question now, and hence this appeal, that they'll be foreclosed from any meaningful relief ever. And that's simply not the case.
What about the argument that it almost seems to be a policy of the DEA, you're just not going to rule. Take this case. Have you ruled?
But any delay since June of 2007 is, I think, attributable to the plaintiffs themselves. In our appendix, I think it's at page 29, we copy the letters that the DEA sent the plaintiffs here asking for further information. Plaintiffs did not respond to those letters, until I think it was January of 2008, so it's 7 months later, and that was only after the DEA sent them a letter prompting them to do so in December. In those answers, and this is all...
So you had their response since January of this year, and it's now November, so you've had 11 months.
So the reason the agency has not acted on those answers, and this is all, of course, happened after briefing, it's not on the record, is that plaintiffs in those responses pointed to the pendencies of these very proceedings and said, there's an open question about whether the Controlled Substances Act applies to us. Now, the agency, of course, our position is that the district court and this court don't have jurisdiction to decide those questions now. But we acknowledge that the district court disagreed with us, took jurisdiction over those questions, and that this court could do the same. So out of respect for the pending proceedings of this court, the agency has stayed at hand to let this court resolve those questions.
Well, the district court seemed to be concerned about the fact that there was an application pending by the University of North Dakota, I believe, and that had been pending in the agency for, I think it's 8 years now, and they still haven't ruled on it.
Well,
I mean, is that the typical, I mean, is that what happens with these? They just sit there and nothing happens for 7, 8, 9, 10 years?
Certainly not, Your Honor. And first, I think that the course of dealings between an agency and a third party is sort of irrelevant. You don't get to jump to the Court of Appeals because you can point to another plaintiff in district court and said, well, his case took too long, so I know mine's going to be too. Second, there's absolutely no indication of any unreasonable delay by the agency in these proceedings. I think the application was filed in February. There was some communications with the North Dakota Department of Agriculture, some back and forth during March. And by June, they had an inquiry out to plaintiffs asking them some very detailed questions about the proposed cannabis production. Third, to the extent that North Dakota State University's application is relevant at all, I'll note that they have recently entered into a memorandum of agreement with the Drug Enforcement Administration that's expected to lead to their registration to grow cannabis for industrial research purposes. So the idea that somehow the agency has a policy against ever granting cannabis production registrations for industrial purposes is simply wrong. I think, to my knowledge, these are the only two applications vis-a-vis industrial purposes, and so far one of them has been granted. And finally, if what plaintiffs are worried about is unreasonable delay, or if they think that they have suffered unreasonable delay, or will in the future so suffer, there's an action for that. They can bring an action in this Court of Appeals asking the court to issue a writ of mandamus because there's been unreasonable delay. This is a fairly well-established body of law in the D.C. Circuit, which, of course, deals with most of these administrative challenges, and there's a six-factor test to determine whether any agency's delay is unreasonable. So I think the idea that they're just going to languish forever if the district court doesn't address their claims now is entirely without basis.
Now, do you acknowledge that the First Circuit has already ruled against you on this issue?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. And I'd like to note that the First Circuit did not consider the exclusivity of 877. I don't even think they addressed 877's language and the effect that a direct review scheme has on district court's jurisdiction over these types of actions. I'd also just like to note that there's sort of been a false dichotomy set up here between either incurring criminal sanctions or getting into district court now, and that is simply not the case. The plaintiffs can get into court, they can have this court hear this very challenge, they just have to go through the congressionally directed route to get there. They have to comply with the agency proceedings, get a final agency decision. Again, if they think that decision is taking too long, they're welcome to bring a challenge to that in this court. And then once they have an agency decision, if they feel aggrieved by it, they're welcome to file in this court or the D.C. Circuit under 877. And I know it's tempting that this case has been briefed on the merits. Plaintiffs have taken time with it. The court has taken time with it. So it's tempting just to practice jurisdictional avoidance to get to the constitutional question.
Well, that's not what our cases say. Our cases say when there's a legitimate constitutional dispute, it's appropriate for us to address that and not require administrative exhaustion.
I think that's only true I think you're referring to the Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life case, and there the court noted that the only times when we allow these sorts of pre-enforcement challenges are either when there's a First Amendment type of challenge because of the potential for chilling effect, or because there's a sort of compliance burden that it's, you know, that the there are immediate self-executing compliance burdens associated with the administrative process. And that's simply not the case here. The agency isn't imposing any affirmative burdens on plaintiffs. They're simply asking that plaintiffs go through the congressionally directed case-by-case registration process. And if they have some problems with that registration process, be they statutory or constitutional, the agency should get a chance to resolve those concerns before plaintiffs bring a challenge in this court. So I think that the times when pre-enforcement challenges are fairly narrow. They don't sort of extend to anybody's constitutional claim on any grounds. I think they've been fairly well cabined. Just a few final notes, unless the court has further questions. I think you asked about the floodgates, Judge Malloy, and accepting the plaintiff's position here on the merits on the Commerce Clause would allow any state to enact a regime that allowed particular forms of cannabis production. And as I think the First Circuit correctly noted on the merits, allowing cannabis production outside of the sort of closed regulatory regime of the Controlled Substances Act really does pose a legitimate law enforcement problem. If you have fields of what looks like cannabis, and in fact is conceivably here cannabis growing, it becomes much, much harder to regulate all of the legitimate cannabis uses. Again, we're not saying that plaintiffs like these can't produce cannabis for particular reasons. We're just saying that they have to go through the registration process and get their individualized registration to do so.
I don't know if the record reflects this or not, but is there any visual difference between the industrial hemp that is being discussed in this case versus marijuana plants that would be used for illegal marijuana use? I mean, could if you were doing a we have these cases involving aerial surveillance where they look for marijuana fields. Could you tell from the air whether one's a hemp field versus a marijuana growing operation?
I think that the DEA report that plaintiffs attached to their complaint, the full report, which was cited by the district court, indicates that there is no visual difference. Whether there is or not, Congress has chosen to regulate all cannabis plants. However, and of course, cannabis plants to some degree, it's not going to look like an elephant, Your Honor. So they're going to look like each other to some degree. And as long as Congress was rational in thinking, okay, to get to the sort of drug trafficking prevention purposes we want, we need to impose a flat ban on all cannabis production, and then through the registration process allow a sort of case-by-case registration for this type of cannabis production that is in the public interest, I think that's certainly rational. And again, that's the only question on the Commerce Clause analysis. The court has no further questions. Government.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. I think Mr. Sandler has quite a bit of time left, doesn't he? Mr. Sandler?
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the question that I just posed about the visual similarity, under the North Dakota regime, we're talking here about a field for which the GPS coordinates and every other aspect of information has been provided to the state and which is subject to criminal inspection. So would presumably be the last place in the world that somebody would try to do anything unlawful of any kind, let alone try to grow drug marijuana. But again, those are factual disputes, and to the extent that they do matter, we respectfully submit that the district court, again, should have treated the papers as cross motions for summary judgment, found the disputed issue of material fact, and proceeded to allow discovery and for the case to go forward. With respect to the jurisdictional issues, it appears that the government's conflated two distinct issues here. One is the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals under Section 877 of the Controlled Substances Act, and the other is exhaustion of administrative remedies. Counsel for the government refers to the congressionally intended review scheme. It should be clear, it should be clear that there wasn't any issue here of forum shopping or end runs, as the government suggests in their brief. These plaintiffs want to be in the right court to submit their claim that Congress can't regulate this activity, that the North Dakota regime is can go forward, and that Congress couldn't reach it or preclude it under the Commerce Clause. Certainly, they want to be in the right court to submit that claim. The problem is, there's without a final decision of the agency, it would appear that the Court of Appeals doesn't have jurisdiction. And if the district court doesn't have jurisdiction either, then it would be a situation in which, in the words of the Doe Court, the D.C. Circuit, on which the government relies, then which meaningful judicial review would be entirely foreclosed. We do not understand the government to suggest that the constitutional claim asserted by the two farmers could have been brought directly here to the Court of Appeals under Section 877. Rather, they appear to be contending that the two farmers, the plaintiffs, should have awaited action or should await action on their application for registration. There, we would suggest that the doctrine, first of all, with respect to the expertise administrative agency, neither the Chevron doctrine nor any other principles of administrative law give deference to an administrative agency on constitutional questions. Those are questions for the court, not for the agency to decide even in the first instance. Secondly, the experience of two factors here. The experience of North Dakota State University, whose application for registration for a modest research protocol languished with the agency for 8 years until this lawsuit was brought and that situation was brought to the attention of the district court, at which point there was suddenly some action on it, indicates why the invocation of futility doctrine is appropriate.
What are the factual indications of futility with this? What are the factual indications of futility with respect to this action? When was an original application made, and how long has it lay dormant?
The original application was made in February 2007. And again, at that point, the application of the North Dakota State to do research on the commercial potential for industrial had been languishing without any action by DEA for 8 years.
But what specific conduct or activity or communication between these applicants and DEA indicates their application process would be futile?
The application of these two farmers for registration was presented to the DEA actually in a personal meeting by the North Dakota Commissioner of Agriculture, who then wrote a letter to DEA requesting expedited action so that there was a potential for cultivation industrial hemp during the same growing season. The DEA wrote back to the commissioner indicating that what these farmers were seeking in their registration was the mass manufacture of marijuana, in the words of the DEA's letter, the most money dangerous substances controlled under the CSA and so forth. So it appears that that language, and it's cited in the briefs and in the record, would indicate that the DEA's decision is also a foregone conclusion, indicating the futility of awaiting decision on the registration application in this specific case as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sandler. We'll show the case submitted, and we appreciate the arguments of counsel. It's an interesting case, and we'll get a decision out in due course. Thank you, counsel.